Hello there, ladies and gents. Welcome to Orwellian Optics, a podcast by Alio Capital, where we explore the intersection of macroeconomics, policy, politics, and particularly how they affect your wallet and your personal finances. I'm your host, Joseph Grudante. I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, AJ Giannone. AJ, introduce yourself.
I'm AJ Giannone, CFA and Chief Investment Officer here at Alio Capital. In each episode, we're going to dive into how macroeconomics and portfolio management are the key drivers of how you take control of your financial future. Chris?
Thanks, AJ. I'm Chris Morgan, Chief Operating Officer here at Alio Capital, and really excited to be bringing the whys of policy to everybody. Why do we make certain policy decisions and how do they impact economics and ultimately financial markets? Got a good one for you today. We're going to talk about a couple things. The Fed cut rates yesterday, as you all know by now. So we're going to talk a little bit about what that's done to mortgage rates and this idea of a neutral rate. Both of those are actually higher. But first, I want to talk about the politics of all this. So they cut rates even though inflation's still high. They haven't done it this close to an election in a really, really long time. So Joseph, make sense of all this for us.
Well, yeah, I think that's the key takeaway, right? I think Michelle Bowman, she was at the Senate vote on the Board of Governors. She wanted to cut by 25 bips. They went with 50 this close to an election. I think the question is, would it really have made a difference if they waited until after the election? And to me, the answer is no. But obviously, the chips are stacked in Harris's favor. And what does that mean for your portfolio? And Trump's talked about doing a lot of things to the deep state and the media. And I don't see any way that they're going to let this guy win, even if he does win. I just don't see them allowing him to take office. And so I think you got to prepare your portfolio for that. And, you know, when they're cutting rates, it really essentially, usually, right, it means money's cheap and it's going to prop up the stock market. And then bond prices are also going to rise. But in this case, I'm going to sell the system. Not necessarily the FANGs or the companies that are heavy AI, but I'm going to be heavy gold, heavy Bitcoin, and definitely heavy oil. So, you know, that's how I'm seeing it. You know, AJ, you could speak to the technicals better, but I just think when you look at this from a macro perspective, you know, when you look at the three big things historically, right, that Ray Dalio talks about these things, internal conflict, external conflict, and the monetization of debt, the debt cycle. When you look at Harris's proposals, it's just more government spending, it's more debt, we're at an unsustainable level, both in public and private debt terms. And so, you know, if you're going to get increased taxes and increased regulations, that is inflationary, right? Because then companies have to offset those prices at the same time you're getting rate cuts. And so that's how I'm seeing it. And I think dollars are going to continue to decline. And so I think, you know, that's going to play heavily into China's favor. And I think, you know, when you look at things internally, they're not getting any better. You have this populism on the left, populism on the right, this extreme polarization, you know, and that's usually the sign of a declining empire, right? Is that people can't come together and work together in each other's best interest. And then you have the external conflict. You have all this rhetoric between the U.S. and China. You have increased military tensions. And then, like I just talked about, government continuing to add to the debt levels. The way we would get out of this is we need to grow our way out of this. So we need to bring in more money than we spent. And that's not the direction that we're going. So with that, AJ, what do you think in terms of the technicalities around all this?
Yeah, thanks, Joseph. You know, the Fed cutting rates here is, I think, historic in a variety of ways. Like you mentioned, you have to go back quite a long time to find another instance of the Fed cutting rates this aggressively with an election, you know, right over the horizon. The tangible outcomes of this, I think, really worry me in respect to the Fed's really inability to address the ballooning and ever-expanding deficit in addition to the interest payments that continue to just build as a percentage of the federal budget and created a real risk that keeps me up at night on a fairly consistent basis around what this means for the average investor and the average citizen of this republic. I mean, you know, you've got a situation where the deficit is continuing to expand, the budget's unbalanced. And to your point, in order to grow out of this, we need some real willingness and some real momentum behind making investments that will drive productivity and innovation improvements to promote an outcome that is more likely to be positive, both from a fiscal perspective and just really for a quality of life perspective of the average person in this country. So with that kind of framework in mind, when you see the Fed cutting rates and doing things that, you know, could otherwise be perceived as inflationary, even though prices have really not come down from the highs that we've seen as a result of this inflationary impulse. You know, inflation's at the high twos, depending on whether you choose the PCE or the CPI metric and what time frame you look at. But with that kind of lens on this, I think it's really incumbent upon the average investor to take more ownership of this process themselves and try to come up with, like you said, a macro view, a top-down view of what these risks are, because these are things that are not historically modeled. You know, we've never really seen a sovereign debt crisis in the United States. You saw little hints of it in the UK with the pension crisis that they had a little bit ago, and it really forced the government to bring in some real fiscal austerity and some discipline into the discourse, which had been previously lacking. And we see that here today. I mean, nobody's talking about the deficits, and we've got an election right over the horizon that should otherwise be a really powerful platform to address this critical issue that the country faces. And it's just completely being ignored, you know, for obvious reasons. Nobody wants to make those tough choices. But what that means is that it's up to people individually to make those choices for themselves. So, you know, when you think about what kind of assets you'd want to add or include in your portfolio to best protect yourself against the kinds of things that this behavior from the Fed and from fiscal side on the legislative branch pushing out increasingly inflationary bills and just reckless spending, I think you have to really focus on those areas that you highlighted, Joseph. It's commodities, energy in particular. It's the hard metals. It's all of those things grouped into an asset class perspective where you've got impulses and exposure. High growth assets like equities, you've got protection from inflation, you've got protection against black swans, you know, specifically like in this case, you know, sovereign debt crisis type of thing. And really, you know, when you look at all that together, the result is that you end up with a portfolio that you necessarily wouldn't find at a Vanguard or a BlackRock or, you know, any of these like major mainstream financial institutions. They're very heavily weighted toward the old school 60-40 approach, has worked well during various periods, but has also drastically underperformed relative to expectations over other periods.
You mentioned the UK and these legacy currencies, you know, Japan, UK, US, they're all correlated, right? That is the legacy monetary system that we had coming out of World War II and initially Bretton Woods II, and then you had 1971, we were off the gold standard. So that's what's mainly been propped up by the IMF and, you know, the Bank of International Settlements. But that system is being challenged, right, by the BRICS systems, right, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And people, they don't take that macro view of their portfolios. Like you said, I mean, I look at some of just other fintech companies, and I see that they put out these charts, right? And it's like from 1920 onward, is it? That's where history started. But what happened before then, right? Did the 19th century look like the 20th century? No, right? Because you have these cycles that have really happened, you know, for the past few hundred years. And we are getting to the end of another one of these cycles. And I think the question is, when it comes to internal conflict or external conflict, is this going to result in war in which the whole system, like, previously, right, where the whole system was blown up and then it was started all over, and then Britain was so beaten down for World War II, it allowed the U.S. to really just have this dominant sole place, you know, on the world stage. But that's quickly changing. And it's only, in my opinion, going to be exacerbated with a Harris presidency. It's amazing when you think about the fact that here's a guy that there was two assassination attempts on, threw the entire judicial system at him. They threw the Senate and Congress at him, right, with the impeachments. And yet people at the top, they don't understand that the state is eating itself. And by the time they do realize, it's going to be too late. And it has nothing to do with Trump, right? It's just, and people focus on the zeitgeist of Trump. It's about the quality of life for all Americans. And are we raising our living standards or lowering our living standards? It's that simple. And we're lowering our living standards. And so for me, I'm selling the system and I'm going heavy. I'm going to be overweighted gold, overweight commodities, as you said. And I will have some Bitcoin in there, right? And that's the play. Yeah, I'm going to have exposure to AI, right? Because AI is leading this fourth industrial revolution. And, you know, there's going to be some companies there that stay resilient. I think the multinationals, I mean, yes, you know, they might be dragged down, but overall, I think they're still probably over the long term, it's good to have, say, an Amazon in your portfolio. I just thought that I will probably never sell in my lifetime. Of course, that could change, but we'll see. But yeah, I agree with your points, AJ. And I think people just need to really, as you said, you know, these traditional asset managers, institutions, they're not explaining this to retail investors. And so, and it goes back to the Auerbach theory. And I think a lot of people are set up to fail, unfortunately. And so, Chris, You know, with that, what do you have next on your agenda there?
You said a lot of interesting things there. One of them, history didn't start in 1920. That's so good. Sometimes we just, you know, we think we're taking a good big look back at history and what's happened. And oftentimes we're just taking a tiny step. If we do take that big look back, we'll see, like you mentioned, things go in these cycles and generally they come crashing down when debt cycles get out of control. Then you see these drastic austerity measures and the collapse of these great civilizations. So where are we looking right now, AJ? Are we in a situation where we really need to be worried? Is this under control? Will either of these candidates do anything to help us here?
We are absolutely in a situation where everyone who at least envisions themselves living in this country over the extended period of time should very well be concerned. The practical outcome of a sovereign debt crisis, whereby effectively both institutions and individuals lose confidence in the ability of the U.S. to meet its debt obligations, would cause interest costs to rise dramatically. You know, I hesitate to use the term skyrocket because I think there's a natural element of just demand, you know, from in things like pensions and 401ks that will always provide a little bit of a buffer because we're so wealthy. But at the end of the day, if interest costs on our debt skyrocket and yields, you know, really do increase dramatically, we're going to be in a really difficult position from a fiscal perspective. And that always ends up back on the balance sheets and the income statements of everyday Americans. Politicians can talk all they want about taxing billionaires and taxing the rich. There is just not enough income and not enough wealth there to extract to solve these problems without targeting the middle class. And that's really the core of this issue, is that the irresponsibility of successive administrations, kind of tying it back to that neocon theme where the politicians have really just been part of the same party for the last 30 years of just selling out the future of the middle class at the expense of a handful of paid constituencies. There's really no outcome here where the middle class doesn't have to pay the bill. And the only remedy for that is for us to make the key investments now while we still have time to do things like promote an increase in the quality of education that raises up the likelihood that people can innovate, start businesses, create companies, and join the ranks of the entrepreneurs that generate the wealth and drive the innovation that keeps this country at the forefront, you know, of the world economic stage, and do things like the CHIPS Act, for example. While debatably very inflationary, we need to be at the forefront and leaders in all the core areas of technology and innovation that are going to define power in the 21st century. If we're spending all of our money on interest payments for things like bloated social services, we're going to be left with nothing really substantive to deploy in pursuit of really staying at the top end of the spear in terms of being able to define what it means to be a successful great power in the 21st century. And Joseph, I mean, you know, I don't know what you think about it, but to me, that's really what it comes down to. It's like, if we don't address these issues now, then we are increasingly backed into a corner. And, you know, I don't know what we do about it.
And we're not addressing those issues. And I almost think it's intentional because the data is so clear. Data is obvious, right? We showed the other day what's happening, where we rank on the world stage from an education standpoint. And you look at our system is rancid. I mean, the teachers union, for example, and you know, the Democratic Party and the war on charter schools. I mean, what was the reason for that? Like, right, charter schools were a good thing. There was no data-driven reason. It was just about, you know, entrenched power. And so if education's on the decline, right, there's no prospect for innovation. I mean, there was this, you know, spirit in America of, hey, we're willing to work overtime. You know, we're willing to do whatever we have to do to be successful. Now it's everyone gets a trophy and everything is declining. And so in my opinion, you know, China is just, they are going to surpass us as the world's leading economy. And I think the hope is that when something big happens, right, that people will wake up and realize that we have to focus on the things that we agree on and work together and have civil discourse if we are going to solve our problems, right? And I think the hope for me is that on the world stage, at least, that humanity is at a point where it won't come to war, that nations will be able to work together and say, okay, this is what you're going to produce and this is what we're good at producing. Globalization can work the same way the United States worked if we have less polarization. But right now, in my opinion, there's just going to be more and more polarization until this thing comes to a head. You know, when it comes to monetary policy and fiscal policy, you have to remember, like, Keynes. I mean, if you look at the Keynes hike, Keynes wanted to use monetary policy judiciously. he was the ardent capitalist. Like people on the left tout Keynes as if he was the socialist. Oh, the guy was a steadfast capitalist. It was only supposed to be used in times of crisis. But we see right now what's happening. It's being abused, right? It's being politicized. And this is what's happened for quite some time. And so fractional reserve banking has led to this point with globalization that the middle class has been completely decimated. And fiscal policy is supposed to be managed properly, right? So that then monetary policy can come in and help out when we have, you know, these externalities, if you will, when we have these crises, maybe every 25, 30 years, but that's not the case, right? So we're completely mismanaging fiscal policy, and then we're abusing monetary policy to bail us out of the mismanagement of fiscal policy. And that's just not going to work. And I think the world sees that, and that's why you see the continued decline of the dollar. But unfortunately, the average person is not looking at these things like the price of gold. And there's a reason for that, because people are selling the U.S. system, right? And so to me, a Harris presidency means that you continue to sell the system.
Yeah. And the final point that I want to make there is that, like you said, the bill always comes due. Nobody's addressing it. You're just kicking the can down the road. And at the end of the day, it's the middle class taxpayer who's going to foot the bill for this in one way or another. So with that as a lens, Chris, I mean, the biggest component, I think, of most people's spending and their daily expense profile is housing. I mean, you've got a house purchase coming up potentially. Like, how are you thinking about this?
Yeah, coming up in the next year or so. From that standpoint, I was excited to see rates come down a little bit, but it only lasted a second, right? We saw the 10-year come down a little bit, and the 10-year is, well, it used to be anyway, what mortgages were kind of benchmarked on. Now it seems to be more like a floor. Can you talk to me a little bit about that, AJ? How'd that happen yesterday? Mortgage rates went up, actually, after they cut rates.
Yeah, and I mean, this speaks to some of the intricacies of monetary policy that Joseph was outlining there. Usually, mortgage rates are set at some spread to the 10-year yield. And when the Fed updated their rate forecast yesterday, you know, they come out and, you know, Chair Powell has a press conference and he talks about, you know, all the different data that he saw and kind of the logic behind his decision making. And, you know, one of the key concepts that he was outlining was that rates are likely to be higher for longer. And what that meant was that the market looked at that and said, okay, you know, we're not going back to this ultra low interest rate regime that we saw pre-COVID. So you actually saw the 10-year yield come down a little bit, like you indicated, right after the 50 basis point rate cut announcement. But then it spiked after that when Powell had indicated, hey, rates are not going back to where they were before this. So for the average person who's looking to buy a house, I mean, this is kind of a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, on the one hand, you get the indication like, hey, you know, rates might be coming down at the short end of the curve. But if they're going up at the long end of the curve, that doesn't necessarily help anybody. The fact that mortgages are priced off of the 10-year yield means that, you know, where long-term rates go, mortgage rates will soon follow. And there's a little bit of variation there, like you highlighted, but it's really a fairly tight relationship over a medium or longer term. And what that means is that, you know, we've already seen all this massive home price appreciation. So generally, monetary policy has a bit of a lag effect to it. You wouldn't expect that home prices would start to come down as a result of potential Fed cuts until maybe a year or two at best after, you know, the start of the rate cut cycle. In the meantime, mortgage rates going back up a little bit, potentially a little bit more, you know, if we see a continuation of the growth theme play out a little bit, although that's, you know, certainly debatable, is going to put home buyers in particular in a really tough spot. Because as you've seen, I mean, purchasing power is certainly down over the last couple of years. A greater and greater percentage of people's disposable income has gone to things like groceries and just really the everyday necessities required to get by because of the fact that things are generally 20 to 30% more expensive than they were a couple of years ago. So now you're in a situation where Fed policy is effectively influencing directly your quality of life because it's defining what the amount of interest that you're going to pay on a home purchase is. And that defines really as a direct function, the affordability and how much a house you can afford to buy with your salary, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, your salary is going a lot less far than it was a couple of years ago. So when you put all that together, like I said, people who are looking to buy a house are in a really tough spot.
I'm more confused now, AJ. I'm in a tougher spot. It sounds like the landscape of risk on and risk off is completely changed. So, you know, I want to buy a house in the short term. I have this pool of money. I don't want it to just sit in cash, but I don't want to put it in the markets either. You know, I don't know. What do I do?
Is there this new equilibrium? I mean, that's the only, I think, potential out of all this. And I mean this global equilibrium where you accept this bifurcated system in the U.S., right? Between those at the extreme top and basically the rest of the U.S. You have different quintiles in there, right? You'll have people at the complete bottom, then you have people at the low, middle, and the middle. So is there this place that the world kind of just settles into and accepts, and that things are maybe denominated in dollar prices, but the dollar continues to decline and the U.S. and China work together? I mean, with the Harris presidency, with there's so much corruption, right? I don't know. I do think at home, having sub-government, which we're likely to have. I mean, the Republicans are going to win the Senate for sure because they have Ohio and they have West Virginia. And so does that help kind of massage things in the sense that the left isn't able to, when I say the left, I mean the right, as we've talked about before in this podcast, it's Orwellian optics, ignorance is strength, right? In the book 1984. So when I say left, I mean the real right. But if they're not able to pass those policies, I mean, we've already mismanaged spending in this country as much as we possibly can. And it just seems like they keep finding a way to kick the can down the curb. And so this thing, you know, should have come to a head already. So is there this kind of agreement globally that they're going to keep perpetuating the system? Because the people at the top are incentivized to keep it going. To me, like I said, I'm loading up on gold, energy, but I will still have exposure to the companies that are, to some of the things that I like, and the companies that are most exposed to AI, because AI is certainly going to lead this fourth leg of the industrial revolution. Before we go, I mean, I do want to ask this kind of trivia question here. Which president paid off the national debt as we speak of monetary policy? Only one has in U.S. history.
That's a good question.
Really good question. Good trivia question.
You got me there. What is it?
Take a guess.
I want to say it was sometime in the 19th century.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Andrew Jackson. He threw out the central bank because he wasn't a fan of fiat currency, and he knew it would be this inflationary tax essentially on U.S. citizens. And so, yeah, Chris Biddle was the head of the second bank, and Jackson used his veto power to throw Biddle and John Calhoun, right? They were colluded. They thought Jackson would not use the veto power, but he did, and he drew out the second bank, and sure enough, we were able to pay off the national debt. Clinton balanced the budget because I think H.W. Bush, you know, going back to his promise, read my lips, right? He ended up raising taxes. So yeah, we had a little bit better fiscal management there because we were, you know, leading the world in growth and innovation at the time. And Clinton managed things a lot like a Republican would, right? So the great 90s and 80s, those days are gone. And so you have to, I think, leverage up your portfolio, in my opinion, from a top-down approach. It's really unprecedented in these times. And so for me, I'm not going to have exposure to bonds. For me, it's going to be the equities that I believe are going to be more resilient in this environment, right? And I think are going to do better, not just because of monetary policy, because I think the effect of monetary policy is waning. You're getting diminishing returns on its efficacy. But I do think there's multinationals and the companies that have exposure to AI that will continue to do well. And then Bitcoin, I think, is going to do well just because it's kind of a digital gold. And that's where I think the younger generation is going to hedge. But gold for sure, and most importantly, commodities, particularly energy, right? Because, yeah, we are not even close to solving climate change. The innovation and technology just isn't there, but you're going to have increased regulations around energy. And so, but there's going to be continued demand. So that's going to cause the price to go up. It's just as simple as supply and demand. So that's how I see things playing out. But anything else, Chris?
So, yeah, so it seems like the best thing to do right now is just to position your portfolio for any environment, really. But AJ, any final thoughts around this?
Yeah, I think the core thing here, you know, like Joseph highlighted, is that, you know, you have to take a big picture approach. It's looking at long-term debt cycles. It's looking at things from a first principles perspective of like, is this a sustainable way to run a country? Is this a sustainable way to conduct fiscal and monetary policy? Taking things in a four-year cycle is maybe emotionally convenient, but it's not necessarily productive toward creating the types of outcomes that I think we're all, again, to Joseph's point, in alignment on as citizens, as people, building the innovation, creating the investments in our future. And when you look at, you know, our competitors on the world stage, specifically China, this is something where I think that they have a fundamental edge, is they're able to take a longer term view. And obviously there are trade-offs there with respect to the fact that there's a maybe a limited element of individualism or democracy or some of the core values of freedom and individualism that we hold so dear here. So we have to fight, I think, extra hard against that real summary issue that we have to address, that the fact that China's got a extreme level of motivation. They have a massive advantage in terms of population. They have a willingness to bend the rules and in some cases break the rules to achieve their objectives. And they can take a longer term cycle. So if we want to be competitive, we have to take action now in the areas that are going to be most impactful. And the way that this kind of explodes in our faces is really if we end up in a hot war scenario. And I don't think anyone wants that. I would hope, Joseph, that your assessment is correct, is that as citizens of this world in the 21st century, that leaders in both China and the US can kind of agree to keep maybe the rhetoric hot and the weapons cool. The outcome of this is by no means certain, though. So it's imperative that you position your portfolio in a way that's going to be robust across all scenarios and across all regimes, whether that's a hot war, whether that's a debt cycle, whether that's another, you know, second rebound in inflation because, you know, Powell went off half-cocked here, you know, whatever it is, you have to take that top-down approach and see these things for what they are and really build your portfolio in a way that's both robust and opportunistic. And that's really where we think we're going to be trying to drive that messaging. And Joseph, I mean, that's, I think, the core of what it is to be an informed investor, is to really see through the noise and try to figure out what makes the most sense, just from a data-driven perspective, from a logical perspective, and from the perspective of, you know, someone who is interested in really the best outcomes.
Yes, that's exactly right, AJ. I mean, and that's everything we're trying to accomplish at Alio Capital, right? Is to help people take this top-down macro approach to investing. There's just too many unknown variables, and global markets are going to be idiosyncratic, and you have to have a portfolio that's dynamic in the sense that it's defensive and it's positioned for a potential black swan event, but at the same time, it has the elasticity to capture upside.
And with that, folks, that wraps up this episode of Orwellian Optics. We hope you found the discussion insightful. Don't forget to check us out at aliocapital.com. You could sign up and join our beta list. And don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, YouTube Music, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for joining us. Peace and love. See you next time.
Thanks, everybody.